I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is signing the $787 billion stimulus bill today in a Denver museum equipped with solar panels that highlights Colorado's emphasis on green energy. The stimulus plan sets aside $80 billion for renewable domestic energy projects. And in a moment, we're going to see if green energy companies feel ready for such a huge infusion of cash. But first, let's go to Boulder, Colorado, which Xcel Energy has turned into a pilot project for smart grid technology, allowing utilities and consumers to save money by monitoring power consumption in real time. 100,000 people live in Boulder. Every home is going to be hooked up to the smart grid by this summer, and the stimulus bill sets aside $4.5 billion for smart grids nationwide. But the Chancellor's residence at the University of Colorado Boulder is already the model home for the project. Val Peterson is the wife of Chancellor Bud Peterson. And Val, how does it work? How do you monitor your energy consumption?
I have four thermostats that are hooked up into this experiment, and I can either change my thermostats online or manually.
And so if you're traveling, for instance, and you're realizing, wow, I'm out of the house, I should turn it down, you can do it from away?
Exactly. If you hand me a live computer anywhere in the world, I can change the temperature of my house, even take it from winter to, say, vacation mode.
And you can also see in real time how much power you're using. So tell us how that translates to saving money.
I have panels that have pie charts and graphs and dollars and kilowatts, and I can tell exactly how much I'm saving. And I have what I call my cheerleader panel. That is sort of a motivational tool, and some of the messages I might receive are, the energy that you saved is equivalent to taking 13 cars off the road for one day, or powering 9 street lamps on a city block for a week, or something like that.
Well, in the house that you and your husband live in, it's the Chancellor House, it's not yours. How much has energy consumption there dropped?
It's dropped about 30%.
Well, we understand there's some education involved with this, too. So you're made aware of what source of energy there is at different times of the day so that you can choose. Explain how you would use that.
Xcel Energy typically uses coal-fired power plants in the morning, solar power in the afternoon, and then after the sun goes down, it's wind power.
So how would you apply that, let's say, to your Ford Escape hybrid, which has been retrofitted? It's a plug-in electric hybrid. How would you apply that knowledge to plugging in your car?
I can tell it to charge in the morning, afternoon, or evening.
So with the knowledge you have, you can decide, well, let me power it overnight because that's cheaper power.
Exactly. It's a good time to charge.
Right.
It's clean, green energy, and it's not stressing out the power grid.
And we understand that you can also sell the electricity that you create charging the car back to the company?
Yes, ma'am.
So, in fact, you become sort of, your car becomes sort of a mobile storage device.
Exactly, exactly. And with many, many people, with these more mobile storage devices, many people will be able to sell energy back to the grid. That's the hope.
I still haven't figured out how to override my dryer, which has all sorts of sensors. It's energy efficient, but it keeps deciding that the wash is dry when it's not. You know, is there going to be a challenge to applying all of this, which seems to take some tech savvy, outside of Boulder?
No, it's not that hard. I mean, I am not a research scientist. I'm not an engineer. I'm a retired Spanish teacher. And I can do this, and what I like about it is I just plug and play. I just set my settings for maybe my winter mode. I maybe tweak them the next few days, but then I just leave it alone. I don't even think about it. It's wonderful.
It sounds as if you're having a terrific time with this, but this was all done for the Chancellor's house. For instance, the hybrid that you were given probably costs around $60,000 after it's retrofitted for it to become a plug-in.
It is.
I mean, is this expensive technology, even with the stimulus? Do you see this translating very soon to other homes?
Yes, I do. Just like with any new technology, just like a cell phone or a laptop computer, it comes out, it's very, very expensive, not very many people have them, they work the bugs out of it, and then immediately the price drops. And that is what I believe. I'm sure that will happen with this project as well, as more research is done.
That's Val Peterson of Boulder, Colorado. She lives in the Chancellor's residence at the University of Colorado Boulder. It's the model home for the smart grid technology that President Obama hopes to stimulate with the stimulus package. Val, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And as we said, Val Peterson seems very happy with her home. But some people in Colorado are wondering, is the stimulus bill money to expand energy efficiency going to be a blessing or a curse? Gargi Chakrabarty is business reporter for the Rocky Mountain News. And Gargi, are you hearing from people who are worried about being able to put the money to use when they get it?
Yes, I have heard back from some organizations and industries that are, in fact, worried about this huge, huge influx of money coming into these organizations. Most of these, for instance, we have a solar industry here in Colorado, which has about 200 companies. The number sounds large, but if you look around most of the companies, a majority of them probably have five employees or fewer than that. So when you have these solar companies who really have very, very modest staffing levels and skill sets, and then suddenly you are giving so much money to them and expecting them to go around and install commercial projects or, you know, panels on residential homes, it could be overwhelming for them.
Well, we understand to train people and get them up to speed takes a while. We're reading in one of the papers there that a local agency that weatherizes low-income homes is going to mm-hmm. be getting $1 million mm-hmm. from the stimulus bill. This is Long's Peak Energy Conservation, and the head of that agency, Amy Hollander, says she's worried she's going to have to give some of this $1 million from the stimulus package back because there's a short time frame for using the money under the rules of the bill, and she's not sure she's going to be able to train new staff to come up to the level of state standards and be able to evaluate homes for the program. Are you hearing things like that?
Yes, I'm hearing those kind of stories. Howard Geller of the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project that works to improve energy efficiency across the state, he has raised concerns. In a note that he sent me yesterday, he says, and I'm quoting here directly from the note, he says that the amount of increase contemplated in the stimulus bill is daunting. And he goes on to say, the Department of Energy's R&D programs approximately will receive double the money in a very short period of time. And state offices that are now receiving $50 million per year from the DOE will go on to receive $3 billion. He poses the questions, can current energy efficiency programs at the federal, state, and local levels absorb and spend that very large funding increases, including in the stimulus bill? Are there enough staff and contractors to administer and implement greatly expanded programs without wasting funds and potentially giving energy efficiency a black eye? In
right.
the sense that, you're wasting funds. You're not really doing anything. So And I'm sure that agency you just spoke about, and I've talked to other agencies here, and they are, it's a fledgling industry. Energy efficiency industry mostly is, they're just trying to get up to speed. And even the renewable energy industry, I know the governor's office has been working with local community colleges here to introduce courses to train young people. These industries, for instance, a wind turbine manufacturing facility, such an industry never existed in Colorado before. So you don't know what skill sets they need. Vestas, which is one of the biggest wind turbine manufacturers in the world, and they have this huge complex they are planning in Colorado, they went to the state and said, hey, we need some help with training. So there would be a lag between the industry as it is today and the workforce that you need to go to where you want to be.
Well, meanwhile, as you said, Governor Bill Ritter there has made this effort to promote and attract green energy jobs, as you say, train people to be able to carry out that work.
Right.
But how much money is coming into Colorado? Because as you said, the concern is the money's going to come and they may not be able to get up to speed in time.
There are various estimates, but it's fair to say anywhere from $1.9 billion to $2.1 billion.
Whoa.
And then about $130 million will flow directly into energy projects. And the governor has already sent a letter to the Obama administration identifying the shovel-ready projects that are, ready to go as soon as money comes in. And I believe he has identified about $2 billion worth of shovel-ready projects
right.
that we have in Colorado.
Well, and as you said, millions of the money coming in is for grants for research and development or helping low-income families weatherize their homes. But
right.
there is money coming in for these shovel-ready projects to build highways, to build mass transit. Are the people ready to do those jobs?
People will be ready to do those jobs because, you know, as you can imagine, unemployment rate has only jumped here in Colorado. So, yeah, there is definitely a need for jobs.
That's Gargi Chakrabarty, business reporter for the Rocky Mountain News there in Denver. Gargi, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, as Colorado shines in the limelight today, the Golden State is losing luster. Let's check in California, where 20,000 state employees are expecting pink slips today, and state lawmakers began another marathon session to try to reduce the state's $40 billion deficit. John Myers is monitoring that deadlock from Sacramento, where he's bureau chief for KQED. John, Democratic leaders say no one goes home until they reach a deal. Senate legislators have been advised to bring a toothbrush. We know by law they have to balance the budget. What's the sticking point?
Well, the sticking point, frankly, is how to close that huge gap. I mean, we have, as you said, a $40 billion shortfall in California over the next 18 months. In dollar amounts, it's the largest of any state in America. And the problem is how do you get $40 billion unless you raise taxes in some portion? Because the tax issue is the sticking point with Republicans. And California is one of the states in the country that has a two-thirds requirement for a budget vote and a two-thirds requirement for a tax increase, which means you have to get a few Republicans who are in the minority in the California legislature. Those Republicans have not wanted to raise taxes, and right. It's pretty much that simple.
Well, and Democrats have proposed hiking gas, sales, personal income taxes, vehicle license fees. They also want to make program cuts. What do you think the sense is of how this is going to be resolved?
Well, I think ultimately they're going to have to find what is the particular pet projects of enough Republican legislators to get them to vote for the budget. There are a small number of Republicans who have said they'll vote for this budget if a couple of things happen. For instance, if there's more money for my district for one program or the other. And so what you've really got now is you've got Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is a Republican, and Democratic legislative leaders really trying to find is there that spot that you can get that last vote. And, you know, you mentioned about the lockdown that they're anticipating to do tonight. They've done one of those already in the last few days. They did it on Valentine's night, and it didn't unwedge that last vote of Republicans in the legislature. So it'll be interesting to see what happens tonight. But, you know, California's got some serious problems. The state is projected to run out of cash by the end of the month. We've got infrastructure projects that are being shut down because we don't have enough short-term cash to pay them. IOUs that the state controller might be issuing. So the walls feel like they're closing in on the legislators trying to find some kind of deal.
Well, and if you shut down those public works projects, that's thousands of construction workers out of work who are going to join the state workers who are getting their pink slips today. So tough situation there in California. John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED Public Radio. Thanks so much for updating us.
You're welcome.
Well, just ahead, a little more financial roundup on this busy day. Today's the day Detroit car companies have to convince Washington they're worth more loans. Mickey Maynard will join us with that. And later in the program, a doctor who says she shouldn't have to offer birth control to single women or morning after pills to rape victims. And now she has a late Bush administration rule to back her up. We'll be back in 1 minute here and now. Welcome back. Well, time is up for General Motors and Chrysler. Today is the day the struggling car companies, under their federal loan agreements, must show proof that they have a plan for survival. The plans to be delivered later today are expected to include massive layoffs, plant closings, dramatic overhaul of product lines, potential partnerships with foreign automakers, as well as revised labor agreements with the United Auto Workers Union. If that's not enough, the Obama administration has the option of calling in the loans by March 31st, effectively allowing the companies to collapse. New York Times reporter Micheline Maynard is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, following all of this. And Mickey, you know, we've heard so many dire predictions. There have been so many deadlines. It feels like if, you know, you're only following this story out of a corner of your eye, the goalposts keep moving back. Where are we in this story?
Well, in case people don't remember, there was a whole discussion last fall of whether the automakers should get bailouts or be basically told to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Congress ended up not giving the bailout money, essentially because Southern Republicans opposed it. So the ball was thrown into the Bush administration's court, and they granted General Motors and Chrysler some loans. I think it's about $13 billion altogether, with a promise that they could get more if they came back with what are called the viability plans. So today was the day that the viability plans had to be submitted, and then they have until March 31st to plead their case.
And what is the sense of how they're going to do today?
Well, the plans are probably going to be very comprehensive. They'll be filed with the Treasury Department by 5 o'clock Eastern time. General Motors is saying that their plan is about 900 pages, and Chrysler is submitting a plan that has a number of scenarios based on how the economy does.
Well, and what are some of the things that GM, first of all, is calling for?
Well, from what we understand, General Motors is saying that it will go down from about 9 brands to 4, and those would be Chevrolet, Cadillac, GMC, and Buick. So those would survive. They're also talking about possibly more plant closings overseas, not necessarily in the United States. They've already announced that they're eliminating 10,000 white-collar jobs. This isn't just blue-collar jobs, it's white-collar jobs. And essentially trying to negotiate with the United Auto Workers Union and with their bondholders for more concessions.
Well, and the bondholders, may have to take less money in return, take just 30 cents on the dollar if they agree to the terms, and they may get less back on their investment. But what about the workers? Because the big sticking point, what we heard over and over, was that GM workers in particular were being asked to give up some of their retirement benefits. And you and I have spoken before about this. Some people think it's unfair because American car companies have far more retired workers than, let's say, foreign companies who have a younger industry. So where are we on that?
Well, essentially, we're nowhere on that. The UAW and General Motors have been meeting now for a couple of weeks, and essentially, GM is trying to push them to agree to a better deal than a little bit worse deal than the UAW got in their 2007 contract. Let's not forget that they were just in contract talks 18 months ago. So essentially, it comes down to the giant health care fund that was created in that contract, which would protect the benefits of their retired workers. And the UAW has, I believe it's something like a million or about 1.2 million people who are on GM's healthcare plan. It's not everybody who ever worked for the company, because spouses are included in the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's still, there's no conclusion there. But talk a little bit about Chrysler. GM is publicly held. Chrysler is privately owned by a wealthy capital management firm. Some people are wondering, why are they going to the government? Why are they going to the government?
Well, that's a good question. And I think a lot of us covering the story last fall were a little perplexed by why Chrysler would go to the government when they could go to Cerberus Capital Management for an influx of money. But essentially, at the time, the concern was about the auto parts supplier network, and that if Chrysler suddenly folded, that the parts suppliers that serve it might go down with it. And that would affect not only the Detroit car makers, but companies like Toyota, Honda, and the others who've built plants in this country over the past few years. In other words, the country would sort of suffer from the downfall of so much of these parts suppliers along with Chrysler. And so that was why the case was made that they should get a federal bailout.
Well, and just, the alternative, as we said, it was bankruptcy. Where are we on that? Because I know you're one of many who feel that bankruptcy is sort of getting a bad rap here, that it's not as bad an option as the car companies paint it.
I think the picture that's been painted by Detroit of bankruptcy filings is a little bit on the inaccurate side. I've covered bankruptcies in the airline industry, and basically the airlines that filed for bankruptcy protection, by large part, are still operating, and they're probably operating better off for bankruptcy. You could say the same thing for the steel industry, and I don't want to downplay the job losses. There have been a lot of jobs lost. People are making less money and getting worse benefits than they used to, but on the other hand, we still have a steel industry and we still have an airline industry, and it may be time for the auto industry to sort of face reality and say, look, this isn't just time for cutting. This is time to completely reinvent the industry.
Mm. Well, Mickey Maynard, in the meantime, the workers are struggling. We all hear the stories coming out of Detroit, foreclosures because of loss of jobs, because of all the layoffs and cutbacks. And you blogged recently on the New York Times website about an increasingly popular country song. It's by John Rich, which is seeming to sort of gather steam and maybe be The best PR the car workers have had in a long time. We want to hear a little bit of it. But first, tell us, your sense of this song.
Right. Well, John Rich is half of the duo Big and Rich, and he was watching, apparently, news reports about private jets for Wall Street executives and the Detroit car executives taking their jets to Washington to plead for a bailout. And I think he felt very strongly that no one was speaking up for the workers and their families. He is not a son of an auto worker by any means. He's a son of a preacher from Amarillo, Texas. But this really struck a nerve with him, and so he wrote a song called Shutting Detroit Down.
We're going to listen to a little, and as you write, he probably isn't aware that it was Republicans that turned down the first bailout, as you said. Let's listen to John Rich.
In the real world, they're shutting Detroit down. While the boss man takes his bonus pay and jets on.
Mickey Maynard covers transportation for the New York Times and country music at times as well. Mickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin, as always.
Back after the news, here and now.
Yeah, while they're living it up on Wall Street in that New York City town, here in
For 30 years, federal law has allowed doctors to opt out of performing abortions. But a new rule put into place in the last days of the Bush administration expands on that law. It says a doctor or a pharmacist can legally refuse to provide not just abortions, but any services or advice they find morally objectionable, even birth control. In a moment, we'll speak with a doctor who says she's glad this rule is in effect. But first, President Obama is considering overturning the rule. So let's turn to Wall Street Journal reporter Laura Meckler. Laura, as we've said, since the 1970s, federal law has said that doctors and nurses can't be compelled to perform or assist in performing abortions. So tell us more about what's new about this provider conscience rule.
Well, the provider conscience rule basically expands that to not just doctors and nurses, but really anybody who works in a facility that's covered by the rule. And there are quite a few facilities covered by the rule, nearly 600,000, anybody who gets federal funding.
So who does that mean by anybody? Does that mean a receptionist?
Yeah, a receptionist. Let's say a receptionist opposes abortion on moral grounds, and she does not want to make appointments for abortion, or she does not want to make referrals for abortion. She can decline to do so. That's the kind of breadth we're talking about in this rule.
And then how wide out from that allowance does it go? Does it say that, for instance, a doctor who doesn't want to prescribe birth control then doesn't even have to refer their patient to someone else?
I think that would be true, that a doctor does not have to make referrals to somebody who would do something that he finds morally objectionable.
And Laura, we just want to be clear. The meaning of this rule is that anyone can refuse to be a part of a procedure they find morally unacceptable, and they can't be fired.
That's correct. That's exactly what this is. This is protection, job protection for people who might say, no, I don't want to do this.
Well, and lawmakers in Connecticut say they're worried that this new rule could derail a 2007 law that requires all hospitals, including Roman Catholic hospitals, to provide emergency contraception to rape victims. What does this rule mean for emergency care?
Well, I think that there would be a conflict between that federal law and that state law, and I don't know who would win that conflict. It might be something that ultimately would be litigated in the courts.
Well, and the head of the Christian Medical Association says the real battle line in this rule is the morning after pill, and you're saying that this could affect that kind of emergency care, a morning after pill, which is sometimes given to rape victims or women who've had sexual relations.
Sure.
And it might end a possible conception.
Sure. Well, that's if somebody did have a moral objection to it, it would seem to be covered by this rule. It doesn't specify anything about emergency contraception, but there are people who view that as tantamount to abortion, although a lot of medical people would disagree with that. And if somebody saw it that way, then they would be able to object.
Might it also affect artificial insemination or end-of-life care?
Well, artificial insemination is that's a concern that the society that represents reproductive endocrinologists has voiced. Of course, a lot of fertility clinics are sort of standalone enterprises, so you know, it's hard to imagine somebody choosing to work there who was
right.
morally opposed to the work being done. But if that were the case, then that would be a problem. And that person could, in fact, you know, at least it seems that way from the reading of the rule. You know, as you noted, this has, you know, barely gone into effect yet. As for end-of-life care, again, it's not specified in the regulation, but if you're talking about, you know, removing artificial support, such as a ventilator, I'm quite certain that this would protect somebody who personally did not want to turn off those machines.
That's Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. Laura, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You bet.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Michelle Phillips, who practices family medicine in San Antonio, Texas, but last year resigned from the hospital where she worked. Dr. Phillips, why did you resign? What happened?
My story is that it directly relates to the right of conscience for healthcare providers in the way that they practice medicine. And I was pressured to provide a service that I felt that was morally and religiously unethical.
And what was that service?
The service was providing contraception to single women.
Now, a couple questions here. Did you ask women whether or not they were single?
I individualize all my patients. I get to know them. Their lifestyles, their medical history, jobs, that sort of thing. That's all important in taking care of a person.
So it sounds as if in the course of getting to know them, you ask if they're single. And I just to clarify, so we're on the same page with you, are you saying that if you determine that a woman is married, you would prescribe contraceptives for her if she wants them?
It's a case-by-case situation. There are many reasons to be on a contraceptive type medicine.
Some women are on the pill, for instance, to regulate their periods. Or
correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time, you're against the pill as a form of birth control?
No, the issue at hand is not whether I'm against or for a specific service or a specific type of medication. It's whether it's medically indicated for the individual. And if an individual comes into my office and they're requesting a certain service or medication, I'm going to find out whether it's actually safe for them, if it is indicated or necessary. Because all medications have side effects. And in the area of contraception, I'm very uncomfortable with prescribing contraception to women who are unmarried because they are at a higher risk for contracting sexually transmitted diseases, which several are incurable. And we've got HIV, we have genital herpes and warts, and gonorrhea and chlamydia, many that are just devastating to women. And offering them a contraception for a lifestyle outside of marriage, it puts them at higher risk for these diseases, and then I'm responsible.
Okay, a couple questions, because some would say women are smart enough to make up their own minds, you know, about what their behavior is going to be. And it sort of sounds, you know, paternalistic to tell someone that you're going to protect them. But secondly, some people would say that horse has left the barn. You know, if that woman is asking for birth control, she has some plans. And we understand that you are very much against abortions. So doesn't the fact that you'd maybe prevent a future abortion outweigh your concerns about sexually transmitted diseases?
In that light, let's bring in a 25-year-old female. She has no diseases, no problems. I go through a whole routine physical, do blood work, and find out she's completely healthy. Her blood pressure is great. Her cholesterol is great. Her blood sugar is good. She has no sexually transmitted diseases. So I send her on her way and say, everything's fine. But I do no teaching, no education, no advising her on how she can stay healthy. She comes back a year or several years later. She has put on 50 pounds. Her cholesterol is very high. She has high blood pressure. Or she has sexually transmitted disease, genital herpes, and she will need medication for the rest of her life to control the symptoms. Now, would it be better that I did some education and told her what I felt was best for her at age 25 when she had nothing? Let's do prevention, diet, teaching, exercise, look at what the world has to offer us, fast food at every corner, sit-down type activities, let's exercise. These are things that you need to do to maintain your life right now a healthy life.
But let's do
damage control at the end once they've already, like you said, the horse is out of the barn.
Right. That's Dr. Michelle Phillips saying she'd rather counsel patients against using birth control than give it to them. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Dr. Phillips, why can't you do both? Why can't you prescribe birth control and say, now listen, here's what I think you should know. I'm worried that in using birth control, you might have more activity than if you didn't have the birth control. And here's what can happen. You know, even hand out a one sheet on wearing condoms and protecting yourself against sexually transmitted diseases. Why can't you do both?
Because I don't need to. It is my right as a physician to not go against or violate my own conscience. And why should I violate my conscience for someone else's behaviors that they choose to do? And that if they choose to do that, that's their choice. And they have that choice. And this regulation is actually just to protect those of us that are already practicing this way.
It sounds as if you're saying that you shouldn't have to be at all a part of behavior that you don't believe in, which is the premarital sex that we're talking about. But the hospital that you left tells us that doctors in their system can refuse to supply contraceptives. Across the board, though, they say you can't pick and choose. You can't be discriminatory. And, you know, others would say that asking someone whether they're married or single can be very complicated. Many unmarried women have long-time monogamous relationships with the men they're living with. How far would you take this? Would you refuse to refer a young single girl, direct them to someone else?
Again, the right of conscience protects me from violating my moral conscience. When I wouldn't offer or do not offer contraceptive services to women in certain situations, that's my right.
And what about emergencies? What if someone seems desperate? What if it's the morning after pill and you're confronted with a rape victim?
And again, those are case-by-case situations, and according to the right of conscience, I'm not obligated to refer them out. In a situation like that, I actually did have one several years ago, and I sat down and we discussed the issue at hand and what she was asking for and what the morning after pill actually does do to the body, and that I believe that life happens after conception, so it was against my moral and religious beliefs to offer her this medication, and that she would need, if she felt strongly that she wanted to go forward with this, that she would need to see another doctor.
But I'm presuming this woman knew you. You were her doctor. Mm-hmm. We assigned certain things to our doctors. Did you think that you were abandoning her?
I am actually giving her my sound medical advice to not cause harm. And in my experience and my medical judgment, you know, a woman that comes in the day after, not knowing if she's pregnant or not, making a rash decision, there's just a whole lot of emotion there. And I'm modeling after Christ, you know, believing in God and having that personal relationship there. I have searched the scriptures and studied the scriptures and believe life begins at conception. So, again, it's against my my moral conviction, so I can't advise her to proceed.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about that. We've spoken to a doctor who provides abortions. She's almost living in a parallel reality from you. You know, everything is completely the opposite. She's often refused to do abortions because she's felt the woman doesn't seem ready. But she says she feels she has to be there for the many women who desperately, for whatever the reason, can't have a child. What is at the emotional pit of this for you?
I heard the broadcast. I don't see how you can take life in one situation but then preserve it in another situation.
That's Dr. Michelle Phillips. She practices family medicine in San Antonio, Texas. Last year, she resigned from a hospital because she objected to prescribing oral contraceptives to unmarried patients. Dr. Phillips, thank you.
Thank you.
The great Chinese actor Ying Ruocheng was a translator for Bob Hope in Beijing. He played Willie Loman under the direction of Arthur Miller, and he's best known to American audiences as the prison guard in The Last Emperor, and here as the Tibetan monk in Little Buddha.
But remember this. Most important thing of all is to feel compassion for all beings, to give of oneself, and above all, to pass on knowledge, like the Buddha.
Ying Ruocheng was the descendant of illiterate Manchu warriors, and his story is a complicated one. His father became a national hero for resisting the Japanese, then an outcast when the communists took over. And Cheng himself was mysteriously imprisoned by Mao for what he wasn't sure, and then later spied on his American friends at the request of his country. Claire Conceison is Associate Professor of Drama at Tufts University and Research Associate at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center. She's a director and translator herself who became a friend of Ying's and collaborated with him on his autobiography, Voices Carry, Behind Bars and Backstage During China's Revolution and Reform. And Claire joins us in the studio with his fascinating autobiography. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
With your own introduction, in which you explain that, like every biographer, you sort of had to think what to leave in, what to leave out. Mm. And you made the decision to leave out discussion of other women in Ying's life. He clearly loved his wife very much, and so that was put aside. And you also decided to leave out, for the most part, his and his wife's work as informants. You explain, even when they had friendships with foreigners, what did they do?
Yes, this is rather paradoxical because Ying Ruocheng and his wife, due to their fluent English and their kind of privileged background where they had known a lot of foreigners throughout their lives, had access to many influential foreigners, diplomats and other journalists and other kinds of people. And they were asked, like many Chinese at the time, to report on conversations that they had with these people, and even went so far as them hosting parties deliberately to interact with these people and then report back to the government. And Ying was reluctant to speak about this to readers in the West because he feared they wouldn't understand how someone who had these close friendships could also report on them behind their backs. And I think you really have to understand the complex political situation in China at the time to know how real love for foreign friends and duty to your government could coexist in this way.
And even the same government that imprisoned you, which is where his words in the book start. It has here a touch of Hogan's Heroes, you know, the American TV show where he's, you know, constantly fooling some kind of thick prison authorities. Just tick off some of the scenes that he shares.
Well, this is very unique. There is a large body of Cultural Revolution memoirs in the West by Chinese people who were imprisoned and otherwise suffered in labor camps and similar situations during the Cultural Revolution. But Ying's is unique in that he really was playing pranks on the guards. He was keeping a secret prison notebook. But he doesn't brag about this in the sense of doing anything exceptional. He explains it as his strategy to survive without going into a deep depression, without losing his mind, and without committing suicide. He explains it as an anthropological experiment and an amusing game, in a way that he took an interest in the lives of these other prisoners, most of whom were peasants, but that isn't to make light of the experiences that people were going through in prison.
Well, there were many capers. There's the great carrot-stealing caper. He was constantly volunteering for things to get outside of his cell when he had absolutely no knowledge of the thing that he volunteered
yes.
to do. You say anthropological. It also would seem to feed his acting. Here he is playing a prison governor, speaking to one of his inmates, who's the former emperor. Let's listen.
Why can't you learn to look after yourself?
There have been complaints from your cellmates. You must learn how to urinate at night without waking them all up. The way to do it is to urinate against the side of the bucket, not into the middle.
And of course, Claire Conceison, we're reminded in that scene that Ying Ruocheng knew a thing or two about being in prison.
Yes, and I think this really brings us back to what we were talking about, his resourcefulness and his own experience in prison and how this really came to bear on his role as the governor of the prison in The Last Emperor, that it was really something he had lived through and understood. You know, he's a forceful character, but he also has great compassion for the former emperor, and I think that compassion comes across as so real in his performance because of the compassion that he had for his fellow prisoners and because of his identification with that experience. What's really brilliant about the way that Ying Ruocheng decided to structure his autobiography is beginning with this experience of 3 years in prison and then flashing back to his grandfather's childhood, his father's life, and his own life. Because when you get to know Ying Rorcheng as a child, after you've experienced him as a prisoner, you learn about the things that he did as a child, the pranks, the getting kicked out of different missionary schools, that led to this kind of joy for life, but also this clever survival instinct that helped him get through the prison experience.
Well, let's take a look at that, because you say looking at his life is a lens through which to see the entire 20th century in China. So give us a taste. The family rose up during the New Culture Movement. They were descendants of a Manchu tribe. And what's the significance of that?
Well, I would say that Ying Rorcheng was very proud to be a Manchu. And this is one of the minority peoples of China. And the Manchus, of course, came into China from the north in 1644 and created the Qing Dynasty, which lasted till 1911. And then after that, China went through a series of, warlord era, civil war, the Japanese occupation, and then leading up to the political movements of the Maoist era. And throughout all of this, Ying's family was quite exceptional. They went from being illiterate Manchu warriors to his grandfather becoming a leading Catholic intellectual, founding a Catholic university and a free press, a newspaper in Tianjin. And Ying Rorcheng really felt the responsibility of carrying on this legacy of his father and his grandfather.
So we see in him everything from, as a child, he watched a young girl he used to play with have her feet bound, to seeing his father imprisoned twice by the Japanese. His father became a hero to Chinese nationalists, and Ying had to take food to his father every day in prison. But then when the communists win the Civil War, his father is flown out of China. Well, ultimately, Ying survives all these spasms in his country and goes on to become, as we said, probably one of the most famous actors in the country. And he meets Arthur Miller when Arthur Miller's a tourist. But he had to convince Miller to stage Death of a Salesman in Beijing?
Yes, originally Arthur Miller wanted to stage The Crucible because he felt it had echoes of the experience of the Cultural Revolution. But Ying Rorcheng, for two reasons, wanted to do Death of a Salesman. One is that he had read it 1 year after it came out in the United States. So in 1950, as a college student, Ying Rorcheng read the play in English, and it started a dream of his lifetime to stage this production. And secondly, he felt that the pains of the Cultural Revolution had been expressed, and that what China needed was new ideas and a new way of looking at the universal human experience. And he felt Death of a Salesman was a truly breakthrough style of theater that the Chinese could be enlightened by.
Well, of course it's in Chinese, but here is Ying playing Willy Loman. I'm surprised that they were allowed to stage it. He played Willy Loman. And I just, how did China respond to this, emasculated, beaten down worker, Willy Loman?
Well, I think at first there were concerns that Chinese wouldn't understand the capitalist experience of the salesman in the United States. But what Ying Rorcheng focused on was his love for his sons and this filial relationship of father to son, and that he would sacrifice his life for his sons in the act of suicide, and that this was something that Willy Loman, as played by Ying Rorcheng, was proud of and jubilant about. And when the audience sees this touching scene, of course, they're mourning the loss of this wonderful character. And I think he thought that is what really spoke to the Chinese people, was this relationship between fathers and sons.
That's Claire Consisan. She's associate professor of drama at Tufts University and collaborated with modern China's most famous actor, the now late Ying Rorcheng, on his just-published autobiography, Voices Carry, Behind Bars and Backstage During China's Revolution and Reform. Clara, did he get to see it?
The book, no. He died in December of 2003 when we were still working on the project, but he knew that it was forthcoming, and we did get to collect all the material for the book before he passed away, and he's very much missed.
Claire, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.